This is Ancient Afterlives, surprisingly modern ideas from the ancient world. This episode is presented by Kat Gwyther and Simeon Whiting, with our guest, Dr. Tupa Gera.
Tupa. So Tupa Gera is here to talk about her research in Dead Sea Scrolls and magic, and particularly on the textuality of magic. It's a paper that she shared with both Simeon and myself, and I'm really excited to talk about it. I feel like before we start, we need to get some context because I don't do anything with Dead Sea Scrolls, and Simeon doesn't either. We are Hebrew Bible ignorant. So the first question, I guess, is what are the Dead Sea Scrolls? Why are they important? And I think most importantly, why do you love them?
Well, let me think. Why do I love them? Well, I like them. I'm not sure I love them. No, I do. You always love your subject. It's terrible. But the Dead Sea Scrolls, some people would say it's the biggest discovery, archaeological discovery in the 20th century. So it's basically a group of texts that were discovered in caves in around the 50s, 49, 50s, it's the date is a bit messy. But anyway, it's the largest group of texts from this period that has ever been found. And actually, it's interesting because when we talk about Dead Sea Scrolls, people usually think about the scrolls that were found in Qumran, which is a group among the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the Dead Sea Scrolls also includes texts from other areas. Basically, any text found around the Dead Sea, it's called the Dead Sea Scroll, which is very creative name, I guess. Okay. But so the texts I work with are the ones from Qumran, which are in this smaller area, and they are basically Jewish religious texts, a variety of Jewish religious texts, and people usually for a very long time we have looked into them, separating them from the ones that are in the Hebrew Bible and the ones that made to the Hebrew Bible later and others. But when we think about them in their context and where they were found and etc., there is nothing indicating that some of them were more important or some of them would be considered better and others not so authoritative or anything like that. So it's a fantastic discovery. It's a fantastic group of texts, around 900 texts, 15,000 fragments. And you guys can imagine it's like most of them are just like little pieces and they have like one word or one letter on it. So you need to work with them. It's a lot of reading, but a lot of trying to decipher what they would say because they are so fragmentary sometimes.
Well, I did not realize there was 900. I kind of, in my head, that is not, I've got like a little, the penguin translation. So in my head, that's the Dead Sea Scrolls. But to hear like 900 texts, like, that's bamboozled me.
But you have to remember that some of them are like one word. So they might fit in a book.
They fit in a book because they are that small. Oh, thank you so much for that. And I suppose the next question following up from that, because equally, magic is not something I've ever really come across in Hebrew Bible or biblical scholarship. So I suppose I always think of associate magic with all the kind of rubbish fantasy books I read or Harry Potter or things like that. So I suppose my next question for you is, what is magic or how do you understand magic and what you understand magic to be in the context of the Dead Sea Scrolls, perhaps the Hebrew Bible? I know you spoke a little bit about the Numbers 5 passage with the forced miscarriage, the bitter water and the text there. But maybe I could just ask you, how do you understand magic and why is it significant as an interpretive tool for you for these texts?
So magic is a very difficult thing. It's a term with a very long history, which makes it difficult to work with, and we need to be aware of this history of the term and the uses of the term along with time to understand it better. So magic has for a long time been used either to characterize the practice of the other. So there is this thing, oh, magic's the is what others do, not what I do. So, and that's, you won't find in the Hebrew Bible, oh, there's this nice magic we do, because magic is always the other. Magic is always the derogatory term. But other than that, if we think about the scholarship, especially 19th century, 20th century in Europe, you have this look upon magic as something primitive or something less important. And this whole idea that the society, all societies would first they would have some type of natural magic related to the elements, and then they would evolve in some more sophisticated magic, and then they would evolve again in some religions. And after that, people would get finally to this amazing thing, which is science. And then you have this whole idea that magic is somehow primitive and magic somehow practiced by those who don't have science or don't are not as evolved as Europeans. So magic is, that's why magic's such a complicated term, because it involves not only this idea of the other and the bad, but also this whole idea of the primitive and the ones who are not evolved enough. So if you look
So we are the
into
sophisticated ones. We have religion, we have science. They are the primitives. What they do is magic.
Yeah,
That's a kind of
precisely.
conception.
Yeah. And if you read, especially like anthropologists and from the beginning of the century, they would always have this perspective, how the other cultures are like the ones, the primitive ones, and how they, as anthropologists, are this amazing civilized people. And also this idea that societies will evolve in the same way as theirs, without realizing that every society is as evolved as the other, they just evolved in different paths. So I like it. I have a lot of friends from biologists, and they usually say, which life form is more evolved? And the answer is always, if they are all living in the same time, they have the same amount of evolution. They just evolved in different paths, because evolution is not something to make you better. Evolution is something to make to adapt you better to your situation. So if the organisms are here now, they definitely are evolved. They evolved to live here now. And because it's very often that scholars use these biological approaches or these natural science approaches to other societies, so we have this crazy idea that there are societies which are evolved and societies which are not evolved living at the same time, which is not true. Everyone is evolved equally, I guess.
This,
So, go on.
I was just going to say, there's almost like a nasty colonial, I'm going to butcher the word, colonization kind of aspect underneath, particularly like in terms of magic. I remember a lot of like Indian and snake charming and kind of that being written a lot of the time as these weird, creepy practices, like ritualistic magic practices. So it seems to me, some of what you're saying, this kind of framing this magic, particularly in the 19th century, almost comes across in that period of colonization and that those other movements towards this end goal of ultimate civilization.
Yeah, and it's that's kind of why, that's one of the main reasons I like to use magic in my work, because I know magic is a difficult term to define. I know magic, it's sometimes it's too broad to mean anything. It's one of those terms that when you look into and the way people use for a very long time, it gets, it's just too big to actually mean something.
So you're coming against this kind of misconception that magic is primitive and religion is more sophisticated, and you're understanding it in a slightly different way.
Yeah, I want to, for me, magic is part of any religion. It's impossible to think about magic and not think about religion. And of course, I'm not saying that the practitioners of the religion would understand their practice as magic, but since I'm a scholar, I'm looking at those things from a scholarly point of view. So I'm not looking at them as a practitioner. So I have this, I can use, I would tell them work terms and work definitions, and they work for me to understand better the phenomena. So I don't pretend to, oh no, I ancient Jewish societies would definitely practice magic and would understand their practices as magical. No, but I mean, it's as a scholar, I can look back into some practices and I can see that there is things that every religion do that can be classified as magic. And
it could be anything that kind of seeks to influence the outcome of something.
Yeah. So the whole idea for me, magic is, it's intertwined with practice. So if magic would be some act or something you do, some very practical thing you do in order to try to change the world around you or some outcome of the world around you. And every religion has those type of practices. And I know it goes a bit together also with the idea of rituals. But I think there are rituals that you can do, not necessarily meaning to change anything. And magic for me, it's the ones with this this purpose to change things. So that's how I frame magic in my research. It's in a way, it's a form to say, hey, Jews also did magic. It's not only ancient Greeks who had this crazy, weird things they did. Jews also did magic. It's not like magic is part of all religions. So it's kind of reclaiming the term in a way, but also it's a way that for me, it works for me to understand the past. So it's also, it's sometimes it's very personal when we decide which terms we're going to use in research. So I don't claim everyone should use the same term. I just think it's easier for me to understand from this perspective.
No, I love the idea of magic. I was really actually taken by reading your paper, this idea of, you talk about being the problem of being an insider in the past and we're all outsiders because of the time. That really stuck with me and kind of spoke to me in a very cheesy way, but really shocked by that idea. And one of the things that I'm really interested in is the way that we can use kind of maybe more modern concepts or ideas that we don't find in the texts and apply them as a way to understand the text. So I almost wonder if magic's a way of doing that, of introducing a term that's kind of evolved into something we understand very differently now, but looking back on the text and rereading these texts with that idea. And I'm going to keep going with my question, because one thing you're talking about there is this kind of embodied practice of magic that, again, love the idea of, but I suppose when I study Hebrew Bible, which is not the Dead Sea Scrolls, I always think about the textuality, and we don't have embodied practice, we don't have practice rituals, we have text. So I suppose, how do you deal with that? How do you deal with the fact that ultimately all we have is text, all we have is material, but you recognize that these materials are probably more than that? I think this also fits in some of the discussion that hopefully we'll get onto about kind of covenants and Ark of the Covenant with Torah materials. And in the text, we see texts as materials within texts and how all that works. And you have a little bit of discussion about that. But yeah, how do you deal with the materiality of the things we have, but also recognizing that this magic is embodied practice?
So for me, magic is, you can't do magic without the body. The body is, it's fundamental for magic. And also for a lot of other religious practices, and we don't tend to remember that. So let's say prayer, which I think sometimes can be used as a magical thing. Let's say thing. But anyway, so it's very different to have a written prayer and to pray are two very different things. So it's the same with the magical things. We cannot and we will never have the body back. Like we can never really see or understand or perceive how the body was used or how the practice was. And but that's true for a lot of other things when we study history. And it's I don't feel that this should make us not study the idea of the body and the way the body was used. And of course, it's very hard to understand the body and the ways people would use their bodies and they would do the practice if you don't have them and you don't have descriptions of them. So I don't think we can ever reconstruct or see properly how this was, how people did things. But what we can see is traces of it in the texts. But more than that, I feel that if we use the perspective of the body, we can understand more about the text. Because for a very long time, we looked into this text from the practice that we have today. So we think about the way we practice religion today, and we usually apply it to the old texts, particularly with religions that are so close to us. Like, let's say, when we're studying Christianity and you were a Christian, and the things are kind of similar from the ancient text, and then it's easier to just transport the practice we have today to the practice of the past. And the same with Jewish religion and so on. And we don't, sometimes we don't stop to think about, like, wait, is our practice very similar to their practice? Because the text might be the same, but there's nothing that guarantees that the practice is the same. And so, again, as historians, I always say I'm a historian. So I would never really, the past is lost for us. We'll never really reconstruct the past. We'll never really properly know. But I feel that when we ask new questions and when we look into the material with from new perspectives, we can learn a lot and we can grow a lot more. And that's why I like to look into texts from the perspective of the body and from the perspective of the material, of the how this material was used in daily life. Again, I guess it's a historian thing. I'm not a theologist, so I'm very interested on how people lived and how were their daily lives and how fear interfered with the way they saw the world and how which practice what they would do to be less scared or anyway, this, so it's a lot from this.
These are hugely interesting ideas. I'm fascinating about how you differentiate between written text, magical practice, how the two connect and differ. I wonder it might be helpful to look at a particular example of that. So, do you have something maybe from the scrolls themselves or from another text you might have looked at? I guess a case study you could call it, an example of how we distinguish between a written text and a magical practice.
Okay, so one of the things I found the first time I started to think about this, I was thinking about the written text as a magical element, a magical material. Anyway, so the written text can be when we think about the written text, because we live in a society which writing is widespread. And you learn how to read from a young age, and most people know how to read. So for us, the written text has a meaning. But when we think about a society where not everyone would know how to read or how to write, then the written text has to have other meanings. It's the same idea with the prayer and praying and have a written prayer. So why have this written text? And then when we think about the written text, okay, so what we have is written text. Why write this stuff? Why someone would bother to write this? And then the second thing is, when we look into Jewish practice, there is this, when the word is written, there is a whole different level to understanding of this word. It's an easy thing about when we think about the Genizas and this whole thing, you don't just throw away the written word. So the written word is not something like we think today that it's whatever you just throw in the bin and it's fine. There is this whole other understanding of the written word. And then, of course, as I said, we always look into things from our life and the way we grow to understand the past. It's normal. So I thought about I know a lot of practitioners of magic today, and for them the written word has this power, and writing sometimes it's the thing that materializes the word and materializes the magical thing. And then I decided to look into the text from this perspective. And then we have, of course, the example from Numbers, because that's the thing. Okay, I can believe the written word, it was important and people would like to write stuff modern magic do that. But then we have this case in the Hebrew Bible where the written word has a different meaning, because if we analyze the passage, it says, you write, so the person writes, and then afterwards you pour water on the writing, and then you drink that water. So what makes the water? Of course, prayer and the intervention of the Lord. But there is this very practical aspect of it, yeah, that is the writing itself and, yeah, the power containing the word itself. And that was the time it kind of clicked for me, like, maybe the words and the writing itself has importance, because, and it's a magic in itself. And I'm not saying all the texts are magical or, just write and everything you write is magical. I'm just saying that there are some, it's probable that some of the texts, when you write them, when they're written, and then you have some magic into it. Of course, it's not only writing any text at any time. As we see in the passage for Numbers, you have, it's a specific person writing, it's a specific moment, it's a, there is this whole context.
And Numbers 5 is really interesting as a text, because I think it's one of those texts that what happens in there, it's the description of kind of a husband accusing his wife of infidelity. So she's brought up in front of a priest, and the priest gives her this bitter water. This is a very kind of short version of a summary. And she's forced to drink the water. If she's innocent, I think I'm going to get this wrong.
She will be fine if she's innocent. And if she's not, she would, her belly would grow. And there's,
and her womb will miscarry and various other pleasant stuff.
A very much forced miscarriage. And it's almost like the writing element of that gets lost, because what happens in the narrative is so horrific in some ways. So it's really interesting that you brought that up. And actually what was coming to mind when you were talking about the writing is Purim in Esther, in the way that when it's written down, that's the point at which it becomes like this official festival. It becomes written and passed down, and very much the text is saying that the act of writing there, that's the important bit. It's when it's written down. So even though we might not class Esther 9 as particularly magical, I think it really demonstrates this importance of writing in a culture that, or emphasizes writing, whereas something we take so for granted to be able to write a shopping list or to kind of write a post-it note not to forget your keys, or things like that is really such a simple idea of writing. I really love the way that you connect it to these kind of bigger ideas. I almost want to kind of turn the conversation to one of mine and Simeon's preferred texts, the Exodus and the Covenant, because...
Oh, excellent. I love where this is going.
We have such a... When the Ten Commandments are given, they're written down on the tablets. We have two instances of writing there that nothing's really, they're kind of sheltered away after that in the ark, and they're carried around. And yeah, there seems to be something more going on there than just a simple act of writing, because then it's treated as something very different. It's carried throughout the desert. It's given this kind of special reverence. When Moses has his hissy fit in like Exodus 32 or 34, and he has to go and rewrite. Seems to be something sacred bound up with that act of writing in the tablet story. I don't know if you've thought about that in any way, but yeah.
Very briefly, because one of the interesting things about the Ark and the written thing, it's not there to be read. Mm-hmm. And for us, when we write, it's definitely to read. Like, we don't write to not read, to keep away. Of course, sometimes you do for studying, and then you write because it's easier to memorize. But in the case of the Ark, you have text inside, and you carry this text around, and you never look at it. Actually, don't open and don't read it, because it's too powerful. You're not supposed to. Indiana Jones and the Nazis learned that lesson. So,
oh, yes. Oh, yes. So glad Indiana Jones came into this. Great. Sorry, carry on.
I really like Indiana Jones, although we all recognize that if he let the Nazis stole the Ark, and they would open anyway, and they would die anyway. And so his part in the story is not that, he doesn't help that much, but anyway. But it's there. It's texts that are not supposed to be read. And we have other instances of texts from the Tefillin are also texts that are not supposed to be read. They are written down, they are folded, and they are kept with you. And I repeat that because sometimes people get very upset when I say that every religion has magic. And I'm not saying that the people who do think about it as magical, but from this structural perspective, from the outside, it is a magical thing. Because there is some special thing about this text that you will never read, but it's written down. And having it written down, it's important in some way. And that's why I started to look into the Dead Sea Scrolls from this perspective. Think, so why people would written down some texts, and why is writing important? And then we have another very interesting instance in the scrolls, that is the thing that sometimes the Lord's name, it's written from with another type of scripture, so it's squared and not in the same type of Hebrew as the other. I'm explaining a terrible way, sorry. And sometimes you also have texts that have spaces, and some people suggested that maybe there was one special person who could write down the name of God, and not everyone, and it's not, and then again this special writing act. And that's why I think sometimes because when we think about magic in antiquity, we think about from Greek magic, thanks Joe, they have archaic scripts, they change the script from and put an archaic way to write when they write the divine name. And we saw that in this very recent discovery from the scrolls, which is fascinating, so they are texts from the Bar Kokhba revolt, so they're later, they also have this characteristic of the divine name written down in an archaic way. And so when we think about magic, and if you read some texts that talk about magic in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they would say there is no material magic in the Dead Sea Scrolls, because we didn't found vessels or pots or what other things that would clearly say to us, oh, this is magical. But then we have texts, And text can be very magical. So I'm not sure we cannot say there is material there that's magical. For me, there is text. There is text that were produced in a special way or were thought about in a different way. And that's why I connect with the, I don't usually study much the Teflon, but I work with this idea of protection against evil. So why you write down texts about protection? Because, so is it to remember? Because if it's a society that not everyone reads and you have this oral element and people pass down things orally, you don't need to write down things to remember them.
There's like two great questions that come out of that. And one comment and a question, I'm going to be that person. But the comment of like, I think because a lot of biblical scholarship has done predominantly in the West, in the kind of the Northern Hemisphere of the West, and we put so much emphasis on the textuality of these materials, because ultimately all we have is text, but there's been great work coming out of Africa and African biblical scholarship about decentralizing the textuality of the biblical text and instead looking at kind of how these texts are understood as oral traditions and moving beyond this understanding of the text as written down and as written things. So I think actually your comments really expose that prevalence and preoccupation with textuality that we definitely have as white Western biblical scholars. But also, I suppose the second question is, how does this relate to things like demonology? Because I know you've written a bit about kind of demonology and Dead Sea Scrolls, but you talk about protection and magic and scrolls. So I would always love to hear more about demonology. So are there any links? Have you done any links?
So yeah, demons, I would say, now we get to my very dear demons. And demonology was the thing that got me to the scrolls in the first place. So I did my master's on the Book of Tobit, and because of the demon in the Book of Tobit, I got interested in demonology and demons and how they are perceived and how they exist in the world. And more than that, again, I was interested to discover and to go deeper into the idea. Did people believe in demons? And if they did, how did it affect their daily lives? Because believing in something affects the way you behave and the way you live. So that's where I wanted to understand better. And I got a lot of questions from people usually, oh, but do you believe in demons? And I'm like, oh, nothing to do with my research, because my belief in demons doesn't affect the way people react to them in the 2000 years ago. But anyway, so and I started to read the Dead Sea Scrolls expecting to have this very well-developed demonology. And this, when we look into like medieval texts, we have this whole hierarchy of hell and how demons work in the hell, and how it's very organized, let's say. And then I was like, I started reading this Dead Sea Scrolls and it's not organized at all. And actually I moved from talking about demonology, and I decided to call them, sorry, English terms sometimes they just escape my mind, but evil beings, because demons are very for us, if you close your eyes and think about a demon, you probably would look into this red skin horns creature, and that's definitely not what is in the text. So I wanted to take a bit of this and look into the text and try to understand the text by the text. So what do they say? They don't have the word demon. Of course, it's in Hebrew, obviously they wouldn't. But more than that, they don't use Shadim, which is usually translated as demon. And they talk about this whole group of things that are evil and can attack you. And when I started looking, I realized that they have way more things. They don't describe them. It's terrible. When you're a historian, you want the people from other times to write down what you want to know. They never do. And then, so you want, I wanted like a very nice description of a demon and say, oh, this is demon. He looks like that. And then it does that. No, there is not.
That's too easy.
So, but there is a lot of text written down about protection and about how to expel demons or how to take them away from you, to make them go away. And that's a very magical thing to do, because you're taking an action to change the outcome around you. You're taking an action to find protection. And so that's why I got to apotropaic magic and how apotropaic magic would be related to writing. Because again, what we have
magic,
is text.
That's anything that protects you from forces of evil, demons.
Yes, yes. Cool. And it's a word I really enjoy, apotropaic. So I use it a lot.
So it also has got me wondering, it's very easy for us, you know, modern, enlightened 21st century people to kind of look at ancient societies and say, well, yeah, this is clearly magic. You know, we've got this bonkers stuff in Numbers 5. We've got this stuff in Tobit about demons. And we've got these Tephilim phylacteries, you know, text you literally tie to your head and your arms to protect yourself against evil. But it made me wonder, well, okay, is this stuff that we do? Is this stuff that modern people do that we might not think of as magic? But if you take a step back from it, you can see similarities. Are there things we do that perhaps we could call magical?
Yeah, definitely. I feel, and I do apologize, and I'm not being disrespectful to anyone, but I grew up in a Catholic ward and in Brazil. I'm Brazilian. I grew up in Brazil, and we are very Catholic in Brazil. Although, anyway. But we approach Catholicism from a very different perspective than when I went to Europe. And I was like, you guys practice Catholicism in a weird way, guys. Where is your magical part of Catholicism? You need more magic in your life. And but so if you think about, there is loads of, for even when you just light a candle to a saint, it's if you look back, and if you're not into if you're not from the religion, you look back, it's a person putting light to a saint and it to a being, to an entity, and it's very magical because you're saying thanks, or you're asking for protection, or you're asking for guidance, or you're doing an act in order to ask and change the world around you. And I would say a different thing. So in Brazil, there's a lot of practices which are very nice. Let's say you want to find a husband. And if you want to find a husband, then you might get an image of Saint Anthony. And then you take the baby Jesus from him. And you say to him, I'm not giving you baby Jesus back until you find me a husband. And no one considered that.
So you take the baby away from the statue.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And sometimes the statue doesn't allow you to take the baby away. Then you might do other things, like you put him upside down and you say, yeah, I'm not putting you back normally until you find me a husband. You put him in the freezer, or you can put him in like a dark place.
This is amazing.
And then you say to him like, oh, look, I'm not giving you back because Saint Anthony is supposed to be the guy who helps weddings and stuff. That's why you talk to him. And no Catholic who do these things would say to you, I'm doing magic. Mm-hmm. Definitely not. They're just normal Catholic practice. But it's very magical. It's very, the practice, when you look from the outside, it's very magical. So I would say that definitely we do, even scientists do kind of some magical and act sometimes. Science is a bit more complicated sometimes, but science is used as religion for many moments. People would say, oh, no, this is scientific, and then no one question. And I'm like, yeah, guys, that's not how science should supposed to work, because it's not like you say science and then everyone believes. It's the same as saying God and everyone believes it. But anyway, so I see, for me, when we look into magic from this perspective of the practice and magic being practice, all religions do magic, all religions. And I say that again, because sometimes people get really upset when I say that. I'm not saying people are doing forbidden things in their religions or not. I'm just saying from a scholarly point of view, looking from this perspective, everyone does magic.
But even tied up, you're kind of, you say you don't want to almost offend. There's always that underlying assumption that magic is bad, in that kind of, oh, I don't want to offend anybody. It comes back to that question of magic isn't a bad thing. It's just something you do. It's not.
Yeah.
It's just a practice. It's an embodied practice that you seek to change the world. I mean, that's a big, bold claim that you seek to change the world, but you want to enact change on something, so what you do is magic. But yeah, then you're saying, well, you don't want to describe something in this way because ultimately the people who practice those things do see magic as bad. And it that's fascinating in and of itself, is that there's that underlying assumption of magic working all the way through this, even... Yeah, I don't. That wasn't even a question. Just something was that tension being teased out there of yeah. Magic is always bad, and it doesn't.
And I think
in that way.
No, and I think because I know a lot of people who actually practice magic from and don't see it as bad, and I'm talking about this reconstructed new pagan religions, and I have a friend who is a practitioner of one of them, and he always said, oh, this is the oldest religion in the world since the 60s, because that's when we started practicing it. So it's a reconstructed religion, which doesn't take anything from the religion. It's okay. It's as valid as any other religion. And that's another thing. People get so caught up in this idea that, oh no, mine is older, so mine is more important.
Yeah.
And it's not like a line. There is no religion that's a single line that developed from this old time. Everything changed. So, but anyway, so they think about magic as a good thing, and they think about magic as their daily practices. And probably because I know a lot of people who do that I never thought about magic as something bad. I was like, okay, magic, a normal part of religion. All religions have magic. And then I talked about it, and someone got really upset with me in a conference. And I was like, okay, sorry. I'm not saying you're doing forbidden things. Magic's not bad. It's just part of it. It's just a way to explain the things you do. And that's it. And then we go back to this idea of writing down and how special writing down could be and how magical could be. And it's not that every time someone would write in antiquity, it would be a magical act. But by writing something, you could turn an everyday object into a magical object. And then I have a very a good example, which is the magic pose. If it's nothing written down in it, it's just a bowl. It's not a magical bowl. And then we call them magic bowls when there is things written down on them. And what transforms an ordinary bowl into a magic bowl? It's obviously a whole ritual. It's not just this. And writing is part of this ritual. So writing is a magical act.
So I almost want to come back to the scrolls then, and back to my favorite topic of demons, because demons is always something I think about when I hear about magic. But do we ever see the demons practicing magic in the same way of writing, or are they ever engaging in magic in the same way that these texts are? Or do we see any magic in demons, or are demons just things that are in the text?
So. There is not much actually on demons, which is very frustrating. We want to have more, and they don't write down about the demons much, or the texts who had more demon stuff didn't survive. So the texts I work with, just a moment.
Oh, is this a guest appearance?
Yeah, she's meowing and wanting to appear, but she will be fine here. So there isn't much about how the demons act, and particularly the texts I looked into, I call them magical texts, and they are apotropaic magical texts. So the very specific group of texts, and they're mostly talking about protection, and they're very fragmentary for my despair. So sometimes they have half of a paragraph, and it's not even like the top half, it's just half. So you have just the beginning of the sentences, which is really annoying. And but then, so I look into them, and we have to make some sense of them. And because they are not, there isn't many other copies in other places from this text. So you cannot take that much from them. And the evil beings, they are not as described doing things. And actually, that's a very interesting thing, because during my PhD, I decided to look into them, into the evil and the good, from the perspective of action. And because it wasn't clear what they did, and the other perspectives just didn't work. And this, so I looked into them, which ones were active and which ones were passive. So is in this text the evil being active, is doing something, or is receiving things? And that's the main framework I constructed. Sorry. I don't know if you guys are hearing this, but
this is always the best guest to have is always a cat. Never apologize for a guest appearance from a cat. It's really fascinating. I love the idea of, in these texts, there's so much of an embodiment, even though we do have text, but even thinking about kind of the way the senses work and how things are described according to senses in biblical texts, how things are described according to bodies in these texts, and how those things are used. It's fascinating that magic also interlinks with these conversations, because it goes on that embodiment, that phenomenological, word I can never say properly, aspect. You continue, please.
And it's so I wouldn't say the evil beings do much magic, or at least we don't have passages talking about this preserved. And that's a very important thing. It, just because we don't have them doesn't mean they would understand that way, but also doesn't mean they did. Anyway, it's a mystery. We don't know. And so we don't have passages that say as clearly things like that. We do have one interesting passage. Let me find here. Sorry, I don't. But you do have, so you do have moments in the scrolls which where the evil guys are the active ones. They are doing things, but they are not writing. They are not. They are usually terrifying. They are usually destroying things more than doing some magical properly things. If it answers.
That's really fascinating, just kind of sparks over other questions, but equally we've taken up so much of your time already. So yeah, I suppose my last question for you is, if people want to read more about your work, where can they go? Where can they find you? Plug anything and everything that you want to.
So I'm quite active in social media. I try to talk as much as I can on Twitter about my research and about ancient things, and of course about other things, because so you can find me with, how do you say the A with a round thing? I forgot. Tupa Guerra. So it's TUPAGUERRA, which it means Tupa War, but it's my surname, so and I actually, that's a terrible thing. I didn't publish much. I tend to say that my terrible. I need to publish more. But it's mostly I've written loads of articles and I keep them in my computer. So my computer knows a lot about my work. It's terrible. But I'm going to publish more. But you can always find me on Twitter and I answer people and I try to talk about my work over there. I think it's the easiest way to find me. I have some stuff on academia.edu, have some chapters and stuff. But my name is not very common. So if you put my name on Google, it's usually you can find stuff.
We will be sure to leave all the kind of the goodies in the hopefully show notes of some sort. But yeah, if you publish anything, please shout about it on Twitter because I will be there reading as well. But thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Ancient Afterlives. If you'd like to contact us, you can email ancientafterlives@gmail.com or find us on Twitter. Thanks for listening.